Blossom. I feel as if I had got a new sense, or rather I realise what was incredible to me before, that there is a new life in nature beginning to awake. It is whispered through all the aisles of the forest that another spring is approaching. The woodmouse listens at the mouth of his burrow, and the chickadee passes the news along. Henry David Thoreau. March, month of many weathers, grumbled John Clare, the peasant poet, and I thought of him as I sheltered from a shower beneath the church's lych gate. Lych is derived from the old English word lich, meaning corpse, and the lych gate was where a group bringing a body for burial would meet the priest. These were the mad March days of rain, then sun, then wind, then rain, then breakfast. I spent all of yesterday's sunshine indoors, filling in tedious tax stuff for my accountant and looking forward to today's outing. It was foolish to have expected that the weather today would still be mild. We are told to expect March winds in the proverb that March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. Germans used to welcome the month's thunderstorms, though, believing they led to a bountiful harvest. When March blows its horn, your barn will be filled with hay and corn. Once the shower passed, I wandered round the churchyard for a while, looking at gravestones. I preferred those with biographical details about the life lived in the dash between the birth and death rates, rather than just banal tropes. For many years, a well-respected local veterinary surgeon. Loving mum, nurse, entrepreneur, publican. A generous and respected friend. One tomb quoted William Blake's words that are a fine guide to exploring a single map. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. And there was a cautionary admonishment from 1786 to Carpe My Diems. Stop, traveller, and cast an eye. As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so must you be. Therefore, prepare to follow me. A fresh grave bore a wreath from the Kano State Government. Intrigued, I googled the name of the lady buried here in blustery England, far from the hot millet and sorghum fields of northern Nigeria. But all I could find out about her life was a link to the expired video stream of her socially distanced online funeral during the COVID lockdown. That global drama was very different from the one that claimed the life of George, a pilot born and buried in this hamlet. He died in the Second World War, aged 18, in an accidental aerial collision with a pilot from the spectacular Deep Cove Inlet in distant British Columbia. George's grave was marked with a red ceramic poppy, alongside his brother Alfred, who was killed in Germany in the final few months of the conflict. I thought of the reverberations of that war rumbling through communities around the globe as I stood before their father's grave, who outlived both his sons by many years. The church lay in the foot of a valley, so I dropped into a low gear to cycle uphill through the rain, past a bungalow called Sunset Towers with a pristine white picket fence and privet hedge. A footpath led into a wood, and I sat down to drink my coffee on a log in an airy clearing where an old beech tree had fallen. The tree's root system, now pointing skyward, was 3 metres across, yet less than a metre deep. It often surprises me how shallow are the roots of trees, although I suppose I only ever see those that have fallen over and failed at their job. Trees rarely root more than 2 metres deep, and most roots lie within the top 60 centimetres of earth. I was sharing my log, but not my coffee, with a gloriously weird, slimy pink fungus called a wrinkled peach, fond of rotting elm, though tolerant of other hardwoods, With the sad demise of our elms from Dutch elm disease, these fungi are now rare in Britain. The infection killed millions of the trees when it was imported from Canada in the 1960s and changed our landscape forever. The disease spread by the elm bark beetle is still moving north today. History is repeating itself with ash dieback, a new fungal infection spreading across Britain. It arrived via imported saplings and highlights the hazard of the international plant trade. The disease spreads via spores that blow tens of miles on the breeze and may well kill 80% of our 180 million ash trees. The footpath out of the wood was lined with shiny, spiky holly trees studded with red berries. Early green shoots of bluebell leaves sprouted under the delicate white and pink blossoms of blackthorn bushes and cherry trees. In Japan, cherry blossom, sakura, reminds people of renewal. They celebrate with picnics beneath the flowering trees, a custom known as hanami. The blossom epitomizes the concept of wabi-sabi, accepting the beauty of imperfections and the ephemerality of everything. Petals drifted in the breeze like snow as I emerged from the wood, pushing through hawthorn trees just beginning to bud, and out onto an expanse of playing fields. A buckled and smashed tennis racket on the ground painted a succinct picture of the frustration of defeat. The wind moaned through the skeletal tree branches, chilling me now that I was away from the wood's shelter. The sports pitches were deserted, and the cricket sight screens were all huddled together in one corner, waiting for the joy of summer to return. I climbed a stile into farmland. A shiny blue Ford Fiesta was parked in the corner of a field. I wheeled my bike round fields of grazed grass and through some that were scrubby, brown and full of thistles. Most contained dazzling green winter wheat seedlings, planted either as a cash crop for next summer or as a cover crop to protect the soil from water runoff, weeds, pests and diseases. Cover crops are also helpful for fixing nitrogen and for wildlife. Bare earth is terrible for erosion, nutrient loss, and carbon release. I dropped back into the valley that ran the length of today's square, then pedalled up the other side, lamenting my lack of fitness as I huffed and puffed in bottom gear. I was riding so slowly that I had time to watch a plump bumblebee busying itself around a hole by the road. Huh, that's early, I thought. I was surprised to find that I was correct, for once. The early bumblebee, of which I'd never heard, is one of our prettiest and smallest bumblebees, commonly seen in early spring, hence its name. It has an orange tail and pale yellow stripes. Early bumblebees nest underground or in the abandoned nests of mammals or birds, gathering in small colonies with a queen, who emerges between March and May. I kept battling intrepidly and ineptly up that little hill in order to reach the first trig point I'd encountered on my map. Having not been up a mountain all year, it felt like meeting an old friend again as I patted the concrete block, a whopping 110 metres above sea level, in the middle of a muddy field. It was a contrasting world from camping a couple of years ago by the trig point on top of Sulven in Scotland, my favourite mountain, with staggering views in all directions of peaks, lochs and islands. Trig points were originally used for the re-triangulation of Britain in 1936, beginning somewhere in a field in Northamptonshire and branching out from there across the country. They enabled the precise measurement of angles that improved the accuracy of Ordnance Survey maps over the next 26 years. Mapping technology has moved on since then, and the country's 6,000 trig points stand now as essentially obsolete novelties. The prolific hill walker Rob Woodall became the first person to visit every trig point on a mission that took him from Lizard Point in Cornwall to Unst in the Shetlands. He climbed Ben Nevis, Britain's highest peak, and bagged the Trig Point by the Little Ouse in Norfolk, which lies 1,346 metres lower, 1 metre below sea level, in fact. It took 2 years of campaigning before he was granted permission to visit the privately owned Trig Point in Fort Borstal, Kent. At the end of his journey, he said, "I'm not sure what I will do next, but I'm not sure I could ever take up stamp collecting." I pulled up my hood against the icy wind and looked around as I ate my salt and vinegar crisps. Fields and woods fell away towards the red-white streaks of motorway lights. It was a pleasant view, even on this murky day. I could see all of today's square, and also landmarks in several others that I had visited, such as the giant pylon and the viaduct. It was so satisfying to be gradually slotting the puzzle pieces of my map together and bringing it all to life.